Chapter 11. Madame Caroline, horrified, sent a telegram that very evening to her brother, who still had one more week in Rome. And 3 days later, rushing to the scene of danger, Hamelin arrived in Paris. There was a fierce encounter between Saccard and the engineer, right there in the workroom, where formerly their venture had been discussed and decided on with so much enthusiasm. During those 3 days, the collapse of the bourse had horribly worsened, and universal shares had gone down, fall after fall, even to below par, to 440 francs, and the fall was continuing. The whole edifice was crumbling hour by hour. Madame Caroline listened in silence, not wanting to intervene. She was full of remorse, accusing herself of complicity, for it was she who, after promising to watch over things, had let it all happen. Instead of contenting herself with merely selling her shares to try to hamper the rise, shouldn't she have found some other recourse, like warning people, taking some action in short? Adoring her brother as she did, her heart bled for him, seeing him compromised in this way, with his great ventures undermined, and his whole life's work called in question. She suffered all the more in that she felt she had no right to judge Saccard. Hadn't she loved him? Was she not his, through that secret bond, the shame of which she now felt more than ever? Placed as she was between these two men, she was being torn apart in a violent struggle. On the evening of the catastrophe, she had launched out at Saccard in a great fit of frankness, emptying her heart of all the reproaches and fears it had been gathering for so long. Then, seeing him smiling, still tenacious and unvanquished, and thinking of how much strength he needed to keep standing up, she had felt she had no right, when she had been so weak with him, to finish him off by hitting him when he was down. And taking refuge in silence, showing blame only by her attitude, she wanted to be merely a witness. But Hamelin, he who was normally so conciliatory, so detached from everything other than his work, this time grew angry. He made an extremely violent attack on speculation. The universal had succumbed to the madness of speculation in a frenzy of sheer lunacy. Of course, he was not one of those who claimed that a bank can simply let its shares go down, as, for instance, a railway company can. Railway companies have their mass of equipment, equipment that makes money, whereas the bank's real equipment is its credit. So it is in dire trouble the moment its credit wobbles. But there was a question of proportion. If it was necessary, even wise, to keep the share price at 2,000 francs, it was crazy and completely criminal to push it up, to try to put it up to 3,000 and even beyond. As soon as he arrived, Hamelin had insisted on the truth, the whole truth. It was now impossible to lie to him, to tell him what he had allowed them to announce in his presence at the last shareholders' meeting, that the company did not possess a single one of its own shares. The books were there, and he easily saw through the lies they held. For instance, Count Sabatani. He knew that this front man concealed the activities of the bank itself, and he was able to follow month by month Saccard's mounting fever over the last 2 years, starting timidly, buying only with moderation, then driven on to larger and larger purchases, reaching the enormous figure of 27,000 shares, costing nearly 48 million francs. Wasn't that mad? A madness of such impudence, it seemed to take people for fools, with such enormous transactions attributed to Sabatani. And Sabatani was not the only one. There were other men of straw. Bank employees, even directors, whose purchases, entered as carried over, exceeded 20,000 shares, these two representing nearly 48 million francs. Indeed, that was just the completed purchases. To these must be added the fixed-term purchases, made in the course of the last January settlement, representing a sum of 67.5 million for more than 20,000 shares, for which the Universal would have to take delivery. In addition, 10,000 other shares at the Lyon Stock Exchange, which made another 24 million. All of this, when added up, showed that the bank was holding nearly a quarter of the shares it had issued, and had paid for those shares the appalling sum of 200 million francs. That was the abyss into which it had sunk. Hamelin's eyes filled with tears of grief and rage. He had so successfully laid the foundations for his great Catholic bank in Rome, the treasury of the Holy Sepulchre, which in the coming days of persecution would allow the Pope to be royally installed in Jerusalem, in the legendary glory of the Holy Land, a bank that would put the new kingdom of Palestine beyond the reach of political disturbance, basing its budget, with the guarantee of the country's own resources, on a series of share issues that Christians the world over would buy with each other to buy. And all of that was now foundering, thanks to the imbecile madness of speculation. Hamelin had gone away, leaving behind him an admirable state of affairs, with millions aplenty, and a bank enjoying so fast and so great a prosperity that it had astonished the world. And less than a month later, he returned to find the millions had melted away, and the bank was wrecked, reduced to dust, nothing left but a black hole over which fire seemed to have passed. His stupor grew. He violently demanded explanations, trying to understand what mysterious power had driven Saccard to strive so relentlessly against the colossal edifice he had built, destroying it, stone by stone on one side, while on the other he claimed to be completing it. Saccard, without getting angry, gave a very clear reply. After the first hours of turmoil and despair, he had recovered his self-possession, standing sturdily on his own 2 feet, with his indomitable hopefulness. Treachery had made the catastrophe terrible, but all was not lost. He would raise it all up again. Besides, if the Universal had enjoyed such rapid prosperity, wasn't that due to the very methods for which he was now being reproached? The creation of the syndicate, the successive increases of capital, the early balance sheet of the last shareholders' meeting, the shares kept by the bank, and later the shares bought en masse so wildly. It was all of a piece. Accepting the success meant also accepting the risks. When you overheat a machine, it sometimes bursts. For the rest, he acknowledged no fault. He had simply done, but with more intelligence and vigor, what every manager of a bank does. And he had not abandoned his brilliant idea, his gigantic idea, of buying up the entirety of the shares and bringing down Gundermann. He had lacked the money, that was all. Now they must start again. A shareholders' meeting had been called for the following Monday. And he was certain of his shareholders, he said. They would be willing to make the necessary sacrifices. He was convinced that at a word from him, they would all bring him their money. Meanwhile, they would manage on the little sums that the other financial houses, the big banks, were advancing every morning for the day's urgent needs, to avoid too sudden a collapse, which would endanger them too. Once the present crisis was over, everything would start again, and be splendid once more. But, Hamelin objected, already calmed by this smiling tranquillity of Saccard, can't you see the tactics behind the help being offered by our rivals? It's a way of protecting themselves first, and then, of slowing down our fall to make us fall further. What worries me is that I see Gundermann in all this. In fact, Gundermann was one of the first to offer help, to avoid the immediate declaration of bankruptcy, with the extraordinary practical common sense of a man who, having been forced to set fire to a neighbor's property, hastened thereafter to bring pails of water to prevent the destruction of the whole neighborhood. He was above resentment, and the only glory he cared about was being the premier money merchant of the world, the richest and the most shrewd, having succeeded in sacrificing all his passions to the continuous increase of his fortune. Saccard made an impatient gesture, exasperated by this evidence of the victor's wisdom and intelligence.
Oh, Gundermann is playing Mr. Magnanimous, and thinks he's wounding me with his generosity.
Silence fell, and it was Madame Caroline, who had not spoken until now, who at last went on.
"My friend, I've let my brother speak to you as he needed to do, in the legitimate grief he has felt on learning all these deplorable things. But our situation, his and mine, seems clear. And it seems to me impossible. It is, isn't it? That he should find himself compromised if this affair were to turn out decisively badly. You know at what price I sold our shares. No one can say that he pushed for a rise to get a bigger profit from his holdings. Besides, if there is a catastrophe, we know what we have to do. I confess, I don't have your obstinate hopefulness. But you're right. We must fight until the last minute, and you can be sure my brother will certainly not discourage you from that."
She was very moved, once more captured by tolerance towards this man with his obstinate vivacity. But trying not to show this weakness, for she could no longer close her eyes to the execrable things he had done, and would surely do yet again, with all the dishonest passion of an unscrupulous brigand. "Certainly," declared Hamelin, weary and incapable of further resistance. "I am not going to paralyze you when you're fighting to save us all. You can count on me if I can be of help." And once more, at this last hour, facing the most terrible threats, Saccard reassured them, winning them over again, and leaving them with these words, full of promise and mystery:
"Sleep easy. I cannot say more, but I am absolutely certain I can get everything back on track again before the end of another week."
This remark, which he did not explain, he repeated to all the associates of the bank, and all the clients who came to see him, frightened or even terrified, seeking advice. For 3 days now, there had been an endless gallop through his office in the Rue de Londres. The Beauvilliers, the Maugendres, Cédille and Dejoie all came, one after another. He received them very calmly with a soldierly air, and with vibrant words that put courage back in their hearts. And when they spoke of selling, of realizing at a loss, he got angry, shouted at them not to do anything so stupid, promising on his honor to get back to the quote of 2,000, or even 3,000 francs. In spite of all the mistakes that had been made, they all still had blind faith in him. If only he could be set free to rob them again, he would sort everything out, and in the end make them all rich, as he had sworn to do. If no accident occurred before Monday, and if he was given time to call an extraordinary general meeting, no one doubted that he would pull the Universal safe and sound out of the ruins. Saccard had thought of his brother Rougon. That was the all-powerful help he had indicated, without giving any further explanation. On meeting the traitor d'Aigremont face to face and bitterly reproaching him, he had received only this response: "But my dear chap, it wasn't I who abandoned you, it was your brother." Of course the man was within his rights, since he had only joined the company on condition that Rougon was in it, and Rougon had been formally promised. So it was not at all astonishing that he should pull out when the minister, far from being in it, was at war with the Universal and its manager. This was at least an excuse to which there was no answer. Struck by this, Saccard realized what a huge mistake he had made by quarreling with his brother, who alone could defend him, and make him so sacred an object that no one would dare to bring about his ruin, knowing the great man was behind him. For Saccard's pride, this was one of the hardest moments, when he decided to beg Deputy Huret to intervene on his behalf. But he still maintained a threatening attitude, refusing to disappear, and demanding help as if it were a right from Rougon, who had more to lose than he did from a scandal. The next day, as he awaited Huret's promised visit, Saccard only received a note, in which he was told in vague terms not to be impatient, and to count on a happy outcome later on, if circumstances permitted. He had to content himself with these few lines, which he regarded as a promise of neutrality. But the truth was that Rougon had just taken the firm decision to finish once and for all with this diseased member of his family, who had been embarrassing him for years with the perpetual terror of unsavory events. And he preferred to be at last done with him for good. If catastrophe came, he was resolved to let things take their course. Since he would never get Saccard to go voluntarily into exile, the simplest solution, surely, was to force him to leave the country, helping him to take flight after a thorough condemnation. A sudden scandal quickly swept under the carpet, and that would be an end of it. Besides, the minister's position was becoming difficult, ever since he had declared to the Legislative Assembly, in a passage of memorable eloquence, that France would never allow Italy to take possession of Rome. Heartily applauded by the Catholics, he had been severely attacked by the increasingly powerful Third Party, and he could see the time coming when the latter, supported by the liberal Bonapartists, were going to force him out of power unless he also gave them some sort of pledge. And the pledge, if circumstances so decreed, would be the abandonment of the Universal Bank, which, under the patronage of Rome, had become disturbingly powerful. Finally, what had clinched his decision was a secret message from his colleague in the Ministry of Finance, who, being about to float alone, had found Gundermann and all the Jewish bankers very reticent, intimating that they would refuse their capital as long as the market remained uncertain for them, and open to adventurers. It was a triumph for Gundermann. Better the Jews with their accepted sovereignty of gold than the ultramontane Catholics as masters of the world, if they became the kings of the Bourse. It was later related that the Minister of Justice, Delcambre, with his relentless grudge against Saccard, had had Rougon sounded out about the conduct to be followed with regard to his brother, if justice had to intervene, and had received only the heartfelt cry, "Ah, if you'll just get rid of him for me, I'll light a special candle for him." After that, with Rougon abandoning him, Saccard was done for. Delcambre, who, ever since he got into power, had just been waiting for the opportunity, at last had him on the margin of the law, on the very edge of the vast net of the judiciary, needing now only a pretext to launch his police and his judges against him. One morning, Busch, furious at not having acted sooner, took himself off to the Palais de Justice. If he didn't hurry, he would never now get out of Saccard the 4,000 francs still owed to La Méchain on the famous bill of expenses for little Victor. His plan was simply to create an appalling scandal, accusing Saccard of the abduction of a child, which would allow the exposure of all the filthy details of the rape of the mother and the abandonment of the child. Such a prosecution of the manager of the Universal, in all the heightened emotion of the bank's current crisis, would rouse the whole of Paris. And Busch still hoped that Saccard would pay up at the first threat. But the surrogate, who had been appointed to receive him, a nephew of Delcambre, listened to his story with an air of impatience and boredom. No, no. Nothing serious could be done with such gossip. This did not fall under any article of the law. Disconcerted, Busch grew angry, and was speaking of his long and patient wait, when the magistrate suddenly interrupted him, on hearing him say that he had pushed his goodwill toward Saccard to the point of depositing funds on credit in the Universal. What? He had funds compromised in the certain failure of that institution, and he was taking no action? Nothing could be simpler. He had only to make a charge of embezzlement, for the law was already aware of fraudulent transactions which were going to result in bankruptcy. This was what would deal a terrible blow. Not the other story, that melodrama about a girl who drank herself to death and a child brought up in the gutter. Busch listened with a grave, attentive face, launched on this new path, pulled towards an act he had not originally intended, but whose decisive consequences he could foresee. Saccard under arrest, and the Universal receiving its death blow. Simple fear of losing his money would have made him decide at once. He liked nothing better than disasters and the opportunity to fish in troubled waters. Yet he hesitated, saying he would think about it and come back later. And the surrogate public prosecutor had to thrust the pen into his hand, then make him write out there and then in his office, on his desk, the charge of embezzlement, which, as soon as Busch had gone, he carried off in a ferment of zeal to his uncle, the Minister of Justice. The deed was done. Next day, at the bank in the Rue de Londres, Saccard had a long interview with the auditors and the appointed administrator to draw up the balance sheet he wanted to present to the shareholders' meeting. In spite of the loans from the other financial houses, it had proved necessary to close the counters and suspend all payments in the face of increasing demands. This bank, which, only a month before, had nearly 200 millions in its coffers, had been able to reimburse its desperate clients only the first few hundreds of thousands of francs. Bankruptcy had been officially declared by a commercial court after a summary report given the day before by an expert called in to examine the books. In spite of everything, Saccard, as if unaware, with an extraordinary mixture of blind hopefulness and obstinate bravura, was still promising to save the situation. And indeed, that very day, he was awaiting a response from the floor of the Bourse about fixing a rate of compensation, when the usher came in to tell him that three gentlemen were waiting to see him in an adjoining room. This was perhaps salvation, so Saccard rushed off happily, only to find a police superintendent accompanied by two constables, who immediately arrested him. The summons had just been issued after perusal of the expert's report, pointing out irregularities in the accounts, and particularly after the accusation of abuse of trust from Bush, who claimed that funds he had deposited in the bank had been misappropriated. At the same time, Hamelin was being arrested at his home in the Rue Saint-Lazare. This time, it really was the end, as if every hatred and every kind of ill luck had relentlessly worked against them. The extraordinary general meeting could not now take place. The life of the Universal Bank was over. Madame Caroline was not at home at the time of her brother's arrest, and he could do no more than leave her a few hastily scribbled lines. When she returned home, she was aghast. Never had she thought, even for a moment, that anyone could think of prosecuting her brother, so entirely free did he seem of any shady dealings. His innocence, seemingly proved by his long absences. The day after the bankruptcy, the brother and sister had stripped themselves of all they possessed in order to increase the assets, wanting to remain as naked, coming out of this adventure, as when they had gone into it. And the sum was considerable, nearly 8 million, in which the 300,000 francs inherited from an aunt had also been swallowed up. Madame Caroline immediately threw herself into all sorts of activities and appeals. She now lived with the sole purpose of improving the lot and preparing the defense of her poor dear Georges, bursting into tears despite her courage whenever she thought of him, innocent as he was, behind bars, stained by this fearful scandal, his life in ruins and soiled forever. He, so gentle and weak, with the piety of a child, and, apart from his technical work, the ignorance of a big ninny, as she used to say. At first, she had raged against Saccard, sole cause of the disaster, creator of their adversity, whose execrable handiwork she could now reconstruct and clearly judge, from those very first days when he had teased her so merrily for reading the code, to these final days when, with the severe consequences of failure, all the irregularities had to be paid for, irregularities she had foreseen and allowed to happen. Then, tortured by remorse for the complicity that haunted her, she fell silent, and tried to avoid openly concerning herself with him, doing her utmost to act as if he did not exist. When she had to pronounce his name, it seemed as if she were speaking of a stranger, an adversary, whose interests were quite other than hers. She, who visited her brother almost every day at the conciergerie, had not even requested a permit to go and see Saccard. And she was very brave, still living in their apartment in the Rue Saint-Lazare, receiving all comers, even those who arrived with insults on their lips, transformed now into a businesswoman, determined to salvage whatever she could of their honesty and happiness. During the long days she spent in this way in the workroom, where she had lived such lovely days of work and hope, one sight particularly distressed her. When she drew near a window and looked down upon the house next door, it was with a pang at her heart that she saw, behind the windows of the little room where the two poor women lived, the pale profiles of the Countess de Beauvilliers and her daughter, Elise. These February days were very mild, so she saw them frequently, walking slowly, with heads bent, along the alleys of the mossy, winter-ravaged garden. The crash had been terrible for these two lives. The unhappy ladies who, a fortnight before, had been in possession of 1,800,000 francs through their 600 shares, would today be able to get only 18,000 for them, now that the shares had fallen from 3,000 francs to 30. Their entire fortune had been lost, swept away at a stroke. The 20,000 francs for the dowry, so painfully saved by the Countess, the 70,000 francs, first borrowed on the farm at Les Aublets, then the 240,000 francs from the sale of Les Aublets, when it had actually been worth 400,000. What was to become of them, when the many mortgages on their house already ate up 8,000 francs a year, and they had never been able to reduce the household expenses to less than 7,000, despite all their miserliness, and the sordid miracles of economy they achieved to keep up appearances and maintain their status? Even if they sold their shares, how could they now live? How meet all their needs with just 18,000 francs, the final debris from the shipwreck? One necessity imposed itself, one that the Countess had not yet been able to face with resolution. To leave their house, since it was impossible to pay the interest, abandon it to the mortgagees, rather than waiting until the latter put the house up for sale, retire at once to some quiet little lodging, and there live a restricted and obscure life until the last crust of bread was gone. If the Countess still resisted, it was because this meant a tearing away of her whole person, the death of what she had believed herself to be, the crumbling of that edifice of her race that for years, with heroic obstinacy, she had upheld with her trembling hands. The Beauvilliers, in rented accommodation, no longer under the ancestral roof but living in the houses of others, in the acknowledged penury of the defeated. Wasn't that really enough to make one die of shame? So she went on struggling. One morning, Madame Caroline saw the two ladies doing their washing in the little shed in the garden. The old cook, now almost helpless, was no longer much use to them. During the recent cold weather, they had had to look after her, and it was the same story with the cook's husband, who was porter, coachman, and valet all in one. It was now only with great difficulty that he swept the house and kept the old horse on its feet, stumbling now and wrecked by age, as he was himself. So the ladies had resolutely applied themselves to the housework, the daughter sometimes leaving her watercolors to make the thin broths on which the four people were frugally living, the mother dusting the furniture, mending the clothes and shoes, thinking she was making some minute economy in the use of dusters, needles, and thread, now that it was she who was using them. But as soon as a visitor arrived, it was quite a sight to see the way they both fled, throwing off aprons, having a quick wash, and reappearing as the ladies of the house, with white and idle hands. Viewed from the street, their lifestyle had not changed. Their honor was intact. The carriage came out properly equipped to take the Countess and her daughter on their visits, and the fortnightly dinners still brought together the same guests as every winter, with not one dish less on the table, nor one candle less in the candelabra. Only someone who was able, like Madame Caroline, to look down into their garden could know what terrible days of fasting followed all that show, that illusory facade of a vanished fortune. When she saw them, down there in that damp well of a garden, squashed between neighboring houses, walking with their mortal melancholy under the greenish skeletons of the centenarian trees, she was seized by immense pity, and would leave the window, her heart torn with remorse, as if she felt she had been Saccard's accomplice in causing this wretchedness. Then, on another morning, Madame Caroline felt her sadness more direct and even more painful. A visit from de Joie was announced, and she bravely insisted on seeing him.
Well, my poor de joie.
But she stopped in alarm when she saw the pallor of the former office boy. His eyes seemed lifeless, his face was distraught, and formerly very tall, he had shrunk, as if folded up.
Come now. You must not let yourself be demoralized by the thought of all that money being lost.
And then he spoke in a slow voice.
Oh, madame, it's not that. Of course, in the first moment it was a hard blow because I'd got used to thinking we were rich. When you're winning, it goes to your head. It's as if you were drunk. But Lord, I was already resigned to going back to work. And I'd have worked so hard. I would have managed to make up the sum again. But you can't imagine.
Fat tears rolled down his cheeks.
You can't imagine. She's gone.
Gone? Who's gone?
Asked Madame Caroline in some surprise.
Natalie, my daughter. Her marriage had fallen through, and she was furious when Theodore's father came to tell us that his son had waited too long, and he was going to marry a haberdasher's daughter who was bringing him nearly 8,000 francs. That, of course, I understand, that she should be angry at being left with no money and no prospect of marriage. But I loved her so much. Even last winter, I would get up in the night to tuck in her blankets, and I went without tobacco so she could have prettier hats. And I was a real mother to her. I brought her up, and I only lived for the pleasure of seeing her in our little apartment.
His tears were choking him, and he broke into sobs.
So, it's all the fault of my ambition. If I had sold as soon as my 8 shares gave me the 6,000 francs for the dowry, she would have been married by now. But there, do you see? The price kept going up. And I thought of myself. First, I wanted to get an income of 600. Then 800, then 1,000 francs. All the more eagerly in that my little girl would later inherit that money. To think that at one moment, when the price was 3,000, I had 24,000 francs in hand. Enough to give her a dowry of 6,000 and retire myself. With an income of 900 francs. No, I wanted 1,000. Isn't that stupid? And now, it's not even 200 francs. It's my fault. I'd have done better to throw myself in the river.
Madame Caroline, very moved by his grief, let him relieve his feelings. But she still wanted to know more.
So she's gone, my poor de joie. But gone where?
Then he looked embarrassed, and a faint flush rose to his pallid face.
Yes, gone. Disappeared 3 days ago. She had become acquainted with a gentleman who lived across the street from us. Oh, a very proper gentleman, a man of 40. So she has run away.
While he gave some details, searching for words, tripping over his tongue, Madame Caroline could see Natalie again in her mind's eye, slim and blonde, with the frail grace of a pretty girl of the Paris streets. She had noticed especially her wide eyes, so tranquil and so cold, with the extraordinary limpidity of egoism. The child had allowed herself to be adored by her father, happy to be idolized, and behaving well as long as it was in her interests to do so. Incapable of a stupid fall, for as long as she was expecting a dowry, a marriage, and a counter in a little shop, where she could have played the queen. But to go on with a penniless life, living in rags with her good old father, having to go back to work, ah no, she had had enough of that dreary life, now unrelieved by hope. And she had gone, had coldly put on her boots and her hat, and gone elsewhere.
Oh, Lord!
De Joie went on, stammering.
She didn't have much fun at home, it's true. And it's annoying for a nice girl to be wasting her youth, getting bored. But even so, she has been very hard. Just Think of it. Not even saying goodbye to me. Not a scrap of a letter. Not the tiniest promise to come back and see me now and then. She just shut the door and that was that. You see? My hands are trembling. I've been like a wounded animal ever since. It's too much for me. I keep looking for her in the house. After so many years, dear Lord, how is it possible that I don't have her with me anymore? And never shall again. My poor little child.
He had stopped crying, and his bewildered grief was so distressing that Madame Caroline seized hold of both his hands, finding no other comfort for him than to keep repeating,
"My poor de Joie, my poor de Joie."
Then, to distract him, she went back to the failure of the Universal. She blamed herself for having let him buy shares, and severely criticized Saccard without naming him. But suddenly, the former office boy became animated. Bitten by the gambling bug, he was still passionate about it.
"Ah, Monsieur Saccard! He was so right to stop me selling. It was a splendid business, and we'd have beaten them all but for the traitors who let us down. Ah, madame, if Monsieur Saccard were here, things would be different. It was death for us when they put him in prison. And it's only he who could save us. I told the judge, 'Monsieur, give him back to us, and I'll trust him again with my fortune and my life. Because, you see, that man, he's like God himself. He can do whatever he wants.'"
Madame Caroline gazed at him, quite stupefied. What? Not a word of anger or reproach. This was the ardent faith of a believer. What powerful influence could Saccard have had on the whole flock to keep them under such a yoke of credulity?
"In fact, madame, I came here just to tell you that. And you must forgive me if I told you about my own troubles, because I'm not very steady in my head just now. When you see Monsieur Saccard, please tell him we are still with him."
He went away with faltering steps, and for a moment she felt a horror of life. That unhappy man had broken her heart. Against the other man, the one she didn't name, she felt a fresh surge of anger, the force of which she rammed down inside herself. Besides, visitors were now arriving. She had hordes of them that morning. Among the flow of people, the Jourdans especially upset her again. They had come, Paul and Marcel, like a loving couple who always acted together in serious matters, to ask whether there was really nothing more their parents, the Maugendres, could get out of their shares in the Universal. On that side, the disaster was irreparable. Before the great battles of the last two settlements, the former tarpaulin manufacturer already held 75 shares, which had cost him about 80,000 francs. A splendid deal, since at one moment, with the price at 3,000 francs, the shares represented 225,000. But the awful thing was that in the passion of the fight, he had gambled without cover, believing in the genius of Saccard, and had gone on buying, with the result that the frightful differences he had to pay, more than 200,000 francs, had just swept away the last remnants of his fortune, that income of 15,000 francs that he had earned with 30 years of hard work. Now, he had nothing. He would hardly be able to clear all his debt, even after selling his little house in the Rue de la Gendre, of which he had been so proud. And in this disaster, Madame Maugendre had certainly been more guilty than he.
"Ah, madame,"
Marcel explained with her sweet face, even in the midst of catastrophe, still fresh and smiling.
"You can't imagine how Mama changed. She's so prudent, so thrifty, the terror of the servants. Always at their heels picking over their accounts. She had taken to speaking only in terms of hundreds of thousands. She kept urging Papa on. Oh, he was much less brave deep down, and would have listened to Uncle Chev if she hadn't driven him mad with her dream of winning the big prize, the million. They got caught up in speculation at the start through reading the financial papers, and it was Papa who first got enthusiastic about it. Indeed, to begin with, he used to hide what he was doing. Then, once Mama went into it too, despite having for so long professed a good housekeeper's hatred of all gambling, it all blazed up. It didn't take long. How is it possible that the passion for winning can change decent people to such an extent?
Jourdain broke in, amused by the recollection of the face of Uncle Chav, evoked by his wife's mention of him. And if you had only seen Uncle's serenity in the midst of these catastrophes, it was just what he had predicted. He was triumphant in his tight military collar. Not one day was he absent from the bourse. Not one day did he fail to make his tiny gamble on the cash market, content every evening to carry off his 15 or 20 franc coin, like a good worker who has resolutely done his day's work. All around him millions were crumbling on every side. Gigantic fortunes were being made and unmade in the space of 2 hours. Gold was raining down in bucketfuls amid flashes of lightning, and he went on calmly making his little living, his little gains for his little vices. He is the cleverest of the clever, and the pretty girls of the Rue Norlaix have continued to get their cakes and sweets. This allusion, made with great good humor to the pranks of the captain, succeeded in amusing the two ladies. But right away, the sadness of the situation returned to their minds.
"Alas, no,"
declared Madame Caroline.
"I don't think your parents will get anything out of their shares. It seems to me it's all over. The shares are at 30 francs now, and they'll fall down to 20 francs or even 100 sous. Oh, Lord, poor old folk, at their age, and so used to comfort. What will become of them?"
"Well," Jourdain replied with simplicity, "they will need to be looked after. We are not exactly rich yet, but things are beginning to get better, and we shan't be leaving them out on the street." He had just had a stroke of luck. After so many years of thankless work, his first novel, issued first as a newspaper serial, then taken up by a publisher, suddenly looked like being a great success. And he was now rich to the tune of several thousand francs, with every door opening for him, and he longed to get back to work, certain of achieving fortune and glory. "If we can't take them in, we shall rent a little apartment for them. We'll manage to sort it out." Marcel, gazing at him with boundless tenderness, was shaken by a slight tremor.
"Oh, Paul! Paul, how good you are!"
And she began to sob.
"Calm yourself, my dear. I beg you,"
said Madame Caroline, over and over, concerned and astonished.
"You mustn't grieve so." "No, let me be. I'm not grieving. But honestly, this is all so stupid. I just ask you, when I married Paul, shouldn't Mama and Papa have given me the dowry they had always promised? But on the pretext that Paul no longer had any money, and that I was stupid to insist on keeping my promise to him, they didn't give us a centime. Ah, much good has it done them. They could have had it back now, my dowry. That at least would not have been swallowed up by the bourse."
Madame Caroline and Jourdain couldn't help laughing, but that did not comfort Marcel, who went on crying all the harder.
"And anyway, that's not all. When Paul suddenly became poor, I had a dream of my own. Yes, I dreamed I was a princess, like the ones in fairy tales. And one day, I would bring my ruined prince heaps and heaps of money to help him be a great poet. And now he has no need of me. Now I am nothing but a burden along with my family. It's he who will have all the trouble, and he who will be giving all the gifts. Ah, it really breaks my heart."
Paul had quickly caught her up in his arms.
"What are you saying, my silly goose? Does a wife need to bring anything? You bring yourself, your youth, your love, your good humor. And there's not a princess in the world who could bring more."
This at once calmed her, happy to be loved so much, and feeling it was indeed silly to be crying. Jourdain went on. "If your mother and father are willing, we'll find them a place in Clichy, where I've seen some ground floor apartments with gardens that were not too dear. Our apartment, our little nest filled as it is by our few sticks of furniture, is very nice, but it's too small. All the more so since we're going to need a bit more room." And smiling again, turning towards Madame Caroline, who was very touched by this family scene, he added,
"Ah, yes,
we are going to be three. No reason not to admit it now I'm at last earning a living. So you see, Madame, yet another gift she's giving me.
She, who's been weeping over bringing me nothing.
Madame Caroline, in the incurable despair of her sterility, looked at the slightly blushing Marcel, whose increased girth she had not previously noticed. And now it was her own eyes that were full of tears.
Ah, my dear children, love one another. You are the only sensible ones, the only happy ones.
Then, before taking his leave, Jourdan related some details about the newspaper, L'Espérance. With his instinctive horror of business matters, he spoke of the office of L'Espérance as a sort of extraordinary cavern, echoing with the hammers of speculation. The entire staff were gamblers, from the manager to the office boy, and he alone, he added with a laugh, had not engaged in speculation, so was out of favor and treated with contempt by all. Anyway, the collapse of the Universal, and especially the arrest of Saccard, had just killed the newspaper dead. The contributors had taken flight, while Jean Trou, in dire straits, held on stubbornly, hanging on to this bit of debris, still trying to live off what was left of the shipwreck. It was all over for him. His 3 years of prosperity had totally ruined him, with his monstrous overindulgence in everything that can be bought. Like those starvelings who die of indigestion when at last they sit down to a meal. And the curious thing, though logical enough, was the final downfall of Baroness Sandorf, who had become the mistress of this man, as she tried in her desperation to get her money back in the confusion of the catastrophe. On hearing the name of the Baroness, Madame Caroline turned slightly pale, while Jourdan, who knew nothing of the rivalry of the two women, went on with his story. I don't know why she gave herself to him. Perhaps she thought he would supply her with information, thanks to his connections as a publicity agent. Perhaps she simply rolled down to him by the laws of gravity, falling ever lower and lower. In the passion for gambling, there is a sort of destructive ferment I've often observed that corrodes and rots everything, and changes even the proudest and most well-brought-up person into a mere rag of humanity. A scrap of rubbish that gets swept into the gutter. In any case, if that old scoundrel Jean Trou had always bitterly remembered the kicks on the backside he is said to receive from the Baroness's father when he went long ago to ask for orders, he has had his vengeance now. For when I went back to the newspaper to get paid, I pushed a door open too suddenly and came upon an altercation. And with my own eyes I saw Jean Trou giving Sandorf a resounding slap in the face. Oh, a drunkard like that, sunk in alcohol and vice, striking that society lady with such loutish brutality. With a gesture of pain, Madame Caroline silenced him. It seemed to her as if these excesses of degradation were bespattering her, too. Marcel, very lovingly, had taken her hand before leaving.
At least don't think, dear Madame Caroline, that we came here to bother you. Paul, in fact, vigorously defends Monsieur Saccard.
Why, certainly, the young man replied. He has always been good to me. I shall never forget the way he rid us of that terrible bush. And anyway, he is a very considerable person. When you see him, madame, tell him that our little family is still deeply grateful to him.
When the Jourdans had left, Madame Caroline made a gesture of silent anger. Grateful? Why? For the ruin of the Maugendres? These Jourdans were like de Joie, going away with the same words of excuse and good wishes. And yet these people did know. He was no ignoramus, this writer who had travelled through the world of finance, full of so fine a contempt for money. Her own rebellion continued and grew stronger. No, there was no possible pardon. There was too much mud. Jean Trou's slapping of the Baroness did not avenge her. It was Saccard who had corrupted everything. That same day, Madame Caroline was to go and see Mazaud about some documents she wanted to add to her brother's file. She also wanted to know what his attitude would be if the defense should call him as a witness. The appointment was not until 4 o'clock, after the bourse. And being alone at last, she spent more than an hour and a half sorting out the information she had already obtained. She was beginning to see more clearly into this heap of ruins, in the same way as on the day after a fire, when the smoke has cleared and the embers have ceased to glow, one sorts through whatever's left, still hoping to find the gold of melted jewels. At first, she had wondered where the money could have gone. In that swallowing up of 200 million, if some pockets had been emptied, it followed that other pockets must have been filled. However, it seemed certain that the bears had not raked in the whole sum. A terrible leakage had carried away at least a third. On days of catastrophe at the Bourse, it seems the very ground drinks up money. Some wanders away, and a little of it sticks to every finger. Gundermann alone must have pocketed about 50 million. Next came d'Aigremont with 12 or 15. The Marquis de Bohun was also cited, having once again been successful with his classic coup. Having played for a rise with Mazaud, he refused to pay up, while he had gained almost 2 million with Jacobi, with whom he had been playing for a fall. But this time, even knowing that the Marquis had, like any common crook, put all his possessions in his wife's name, Mazaud, in despair over his losses, was talking of taking legal action against him. Almost all the directors of the Universal had cut themselves a handsome slice of the profits. Some, like Huret and Kolb, by realizing at the top price before the collapse, and others like the Marquis and d'Aigremont, by treacherously going over to the bears. And besides, in one of its last meetings, when the company was already in serious trouble, the board had had each of its members credited with more than 100,000 francs. Indeed, on the trading floor, Delaroque, and especially Jacobi, were thought to have made huge personal profits, which had already been swallowed up into the two gaping and unfillable chasms created, in the case of the former, by his appetite for women, and in the latter, by his passion for gambling. It was also rumored that Nathanson had become one of the kings of the curb market, thanks to a gain of 3 million that he had made by playing on his own account for a fall, while playing for a rise for Saccard. And his extraordinary stroke of luck was that, committed as he was to large purchases in the name of the Universal, which was no longer paying, he would certainly have been ruined if there had not been a forced clearing of debts, making the whole curb market, now declared insolvent, a gift of the more than 100 million francs it owed. Such a lucky and clever fellow, that little Nathanson. And what a happy turn of events! It made you smile, by which you keep all your profits without paying for any of the losses. But the figures were still vague, and Madame Caroline could not arrive at a correct estimation of the profits, for the transactions of the Bourse are carried on with a great deal of mystery, and professional secrecy is strictly observed by the brokers. Nothing could have been learned, even from the order books, for they contain no names. She tried in vain to discover how much had been carried off by Sabatani, who had mysteriously disappeared after the last settlement. That was yet another ruinous blow hitting Mazaud hard. It was the usual story. The shady client, accepted at first with misgivings, who deposits a small security of 2 or 3,000 francs, and gambles only modestly for the first few months. Then, when the meagerness of the cover has been forgotten, and he has become a friend of the broker, he absconds after some act of banditry. Mazaud was talking of posting Sabatani, as he had formerly posted Schlosser, a crook out of the same stable, part of that endless band of robbers who make use of the market to cover their activities in the same way that bandits once used the woods. And the Levantine, that mixture of Italian and Oriental with his velvety eyes, and endowed, it was said, with a phenomenon that women inquisitively whispered about, had gone off to skim some other stock market. Berlin, some said, waiting until the Paris Bourse had forgotten him, and he could return to be accepted once more, ready, given the general tolerance, to perform the same trick. The next list Madame Caroline had drawn up was of the disasters. The crash of the Universal had been one of those terrible shocks that shake the foundations of a whole city. Nothing had remained steady and solid. Cracks were appearing in neighboring institutions, and every day brought new collapses. The banks were crumbling one after another, with a sudden clatter like stretches of walls still standing after a fire. People listened in silent dismay to this noise of things falling, and wondered where the ruins would stop. What struck Madame Caroline to the heart was not so much the bankers, the companies, the financiers and financial establishments destroyed and carried away in the storm, as all the poor people, the shareholders and even speculators, whom she had known and loved, and who were among the victims. After the defeat, she was counting her dead. And it wasn't just her poor de joie, the incredibly stupid and lamentable Megendres, or the sad Beauvillier ladies. Another drama that had greatly upset her was the bankruptcy of Cédille, the silk manufacturer, which had been declared the day before. Having seen him at work as a director, the only one, she said, that she would have trusted with 10 sous, she declared him to be the most honest man in the world. What a frightening thing, this passion for gambling. A man who had spent 30 years establishing, with his work and integrity, one of the soundest businesses in Paris, and who now, in less than 3 years, had so damaged it, so undermined it, that in one stroke it had crumbled into dust. What bitter regrets he must have for the laborious days of yesteryear, when he still believed in fortune being made by long effort, before one first lucky gain had made him scorn all that, consumed by the dream of acquiring in 1 hour on the stock market the million that takes the whole lifetime of an honest tradesman. And the bourse had taken everything, leaving the wretched man struck down, disgraced, incapable, and unworthy of taking up business again, and with a son whom penury would perhaps turn into a swindler. Gustave, that soul of joy and festivity, living on the basis of 40,000 to 50,000 francs of debt, and already compromised in an ugly story of promissory notes made out to Germaine Coeur. Another poor devil who distressed Madame Caroline was Massius the jobber, though, heaven knows, she was not often disposed to be sentimental about those go-betweens between deception and theft. But she had known him too, with his big laughing eyes, and that look of his, like a good dog unjustly whipped, as he raced around Paris to snatch up a few meagre orders. If he too had for a moment imagined himself one of the masters of the market, after making a conquest of fortune, following in Saccard's footsteps, what a dreadful awakening he had had from his dream, finding himself quite knocked down, a broken man. He had debts of 70,000 francs, and he had paid, when he might have claimed gambling exemption, as so many others had done. But by borrowing from friends and pledging his entire life, he had been sublimely and uselessly stupid enough to pay. Uselessly, insofar as nobody showed any gratitude, and some even shrugged their shoulders at him behind his back. His rancor was directed only against the bourse. He had returned to his former disgust with his sordid job, insisting that you had to be a Jew to succeed in it, but resigning himself to carrying on, since he was already in it, and still had the stubborn hope of making his fortune after all, as long as he still had his keen eye and good legs. But the unknown dead, the victims with no name and no history, especially filled Madame Caroline's heart with infinite pity. They were legion, scattered in remote thickets and overgrown ditches, dead or wounded bodies breathing their last in anguish behind every tree trunk. What fearful silent dramas there were in this host of unfortunate people of modest means. Timid shareholders who had put all their savings into one stock. Retired concierges, pale spinster ladies living with their cats, provincial pensioners with their obsessively regulated lives, country priests impoverished by their charitable giving, all these little people with a budget of a few sous, so much for milk, so much for bread, a budget so precise and restricted that even 2 sous less meant disaster. And suddenly, nothing left, life cut short and swept away. Old, trembling hands bewildered and groping in the dark, incapable of work. All these humble, quiet existences thrown at one stroke into the horror of want. 100 desperate letters had arrived from Vendôme, where Fayot, the collector of revenues, had aggravated the disaster by taking flight. Holding money and shares for the clients on whose behalf he operated at the bourse, he had begun a terrible gambling spree for himself, and having lost, but not intending to pay, he had disappeared with the few 100,000 francs he had still kept his hands on. All around Vendôme, in farms far from anywhere, he had left destitution and tears. The crash had reached everywhere, even the humblest cottages. As after great epidemics, were they not always the most pitiable victims? These ordinary people, neither rich nor poor, people with limited savings. Savings that would be replaced only after years of hard work by their sons. At last, Madame Caroline went out to visit Mazaud, and while she walked down towards the Rue de la Banque, she thought of the repeated blows that had been hitting the broker over the last fortnight. There was Fayot, who had robbed him of 300,000 francs. Sabatani, who had left an unpaid account of almost double that sum. The Marquis de Bohun and Baroness Sandorf, who had refused to pay, between the two of them, more than 1,000,000 francs worth of differences. And Cédille, whose bankruptcy carried away about the same amount, not to mention the 8,000,000 owed him by the Universal, the 8,000,000 carried over for Saccard. That dreadful loss, the abyss into which the anxious Bourse hourly expected to see him sink. Twice already Mazaud's downfall had been rumored, and with fate's relentlessness, a further misfortune had just occurred, one that was going to be the last straw. The clerk, Flory, had been arrested 2 days before, convicted of having embezzled 180,000 francs. Little by little, the demands of Mademoiselle Chouchou, the former variety artiste, the skinny grasshopper from the Paris streets, had grown. First, it was jolly parties of no great expense. Then the apartment in the Rue Condorcet. Then jewels and lace. And what had led the unfortunate and tender lad astray was his first winnings of 10,000 francs after Sadoa. That special luxury, money so quickly gained, so quickly spent. Those winnings that had called for more, and then still more, in his feverish passion for the woman so dearly bought. But the extraordinary thing about this story was that Flory had robbed his employer simply to pay the gambling debt he owed another broker. A singular piece of honesty, due to fright at the prospect of immediate posting, and hoping no doubt to hide the theft and replace the money by some miraculous means. In prison, he had wept a great deal, in an awful reawakening of shame and despair. And it was said that his mother, who had arrived that morning from Saint to see him, had had to take to her bed at the home of the friends with whom she was staying. What a strange thing is luck, thought Madame Caroline, as she crossed the Place de la Bourse. The extraordinary success of the Universal, that rapid rise into triumph, conquest, and domination in less than 4 years, then the sudden crumbling, and that colossal edifice that took less than a month to be reduced to dust. All this she still found stupefying. And wasn't that also the story of Mazaud? Surely no man had ever seen destiny smile on him to such an extent. A stockbroker at 32, already very rich through his uncle's death, the happy husband of a charming wife who adored him, and had given him 2 lovely children. He was also a good-looking man, occupying a place on the trading floor that every day grew in importance thanks to his connections, his energy, his really surprising flair, and even his shrill voice, that piping voice that had become as famous as the thundering bass of Jacobi. And suddenly, the whole situation had started to crack, and he had found himself on the edge of the abyss, into which a mere breath was now enough to hurl him. And yet he had not gambled, still protected by his ardor for work and his youthful anxiety. While still battling faithfully, he had been struck down through inexperience, passion, and having too much faith in others. Anyway, there was a great deal of sympathy for him, and it was claimed that if he could keep his nerve, he might yet be able to survive. When Madame Caroline had gone up to the main office, she clearly smelled the scent of ruin, and felt the shudder of secret anguish in the now bleak offices. As she went through the cash office, she saw about 20 people, quite a crowd, waiting there, while the money cashier and the shares cashier still honored the establishment's commitments, but with slower hands, like men emptying the last drawers. The settlement office, seen through a half-open door, looked asleep, with its 7 clerks reading their newspapers, having only a very few transactions to deal with since the bourse was now idle. Only the cash office showed some signs of life. It was Berthier, the authorized clerk, who received her, himself looking very upset and pale amid the misfortunes of the house.
"I don't know whether Monsieur Mazoid will be able to receive you, madame. He isn't very well. He caught a chill, insisting on working all through the night with no fire, and he has just gone down to his home on the first floor to rest a while."
Then Madame Caroline insisted.
"Please, monsieur, arrange for me to have a few words with him. It may be vital for saving my brother. Monsieur Mazoid knows that my brother never took part in the operations in the bourse, and his testimony could be of great importance. In addition, I have to ask him about some figures. Only he can give me information about certain documents."
Berthier, still very hesitant, at last asked her to go into the broker's office.
"Wait there a moment, madame. I'll go and see."
And indeed, Madame Caroline felt the cold in that room very keenly. The fire must have gone out the day before, and no one had thought of relighting it. What struck her even more was the impeccable order, as if the whole night and all the morning had been spent emptying cupboards, destroying useless papers, and filing those that had to be kept. Nothing was lying about, not a file, not even a letter. On the desk, neatly arranged, were only the inkstand, the pen rack, and a large blotter, and in the middle, a bundle of Mazoid slips, green slips, the color of hope. In the bareness of the room, an infinite sadness seemed to hang, along with the heavy silence. After a few minutes, Berthier reappeared.
"Oh dear, madame, I rang twice and I don't dare go on. As you go down, see whether you should ring yourself. But I advise you to come back another time."
Madame Caroline had to give up. However, on the first floor landing, she still paused, even stretched out her hand towards the doorbell. And she was at last about to go away, when cries, sobs, and a muffled commotion in the depths of the apartment stopped her. Suddenly, the door was opened, and a frightened-looking servant rushed out and disappeared down the stairs, stammering,
"Oh my God! My God! Monsieur!"
Madame Caroline had remained stock still before that open door, from which emerged, quite distinctly now, a wail of dreadful grief. And she turned cold as she guessed, and then clearly envisaged, what had happened here. At first, she decided to take flight. But she couldn't. Overwhelmed with pity, and drawn on, feeling the need to see and to bring her own tears to the scene. She went in, finding all the doors wide open, and reached the drawing room. Two servants, the cook and the chambermaid no doubt, were craning their necks into the room, with terrified faces and stammering.
"Oh, monsieur! Oh, my God! My God!"
The dying light of the grey winter day filtered weakly through a gap in the thick silk curtains. But it was very warm, and large logs, almost burned through, were glowing in the fireplace, lighting up the walls with their red reflection. On one of the tables, a bunch of roses, a royal bouquet for that season, which the broker had brought his wife the day before, was opening out in that hothouse warmth, its flowers filling the whole room with their scent. It seemed to be the very scent of the refined luxury of the apartment. The sweet smell of good luck, wealth, and happiness in love, which for 4 years had flourished in this place. And there, in the red reflection of the fire, lay Mazoid, stretched out on the edge of the sofa, his head shattered by a bullet, his clenched hand still gripping the revolver. While standing in front of him, his young wife, who had run to the scene, was making that wailing sound. That continuous wild scream that could be heard from the stairway. When the shot rang out, she had been holding her little boy of 4 and a half in her arms, and his little hands had clung tightly to her neck in fright. And her little girl, already 6 years old, had followed her, clinging to her skirt, huddled against her. And the two children, hearing their mother's desperate screams, were screaming too. Madame Caroline at once tried to lead them away.
"Madame, I beg you, madame, don't stay here."
She herself was trembling and feeling faint. She could see the blood still flowing from the hole in Mazoid's head, and falling, drop by drop, onto the velvet of the sofa, then down onto the carpet. On the floor was a large and spreading stain, and she felt as if this blood was reaching her, bespattering her feet and hands.
Madame, I beg you, please follow me.
But with her son hanging round her neck, and her daughter pressed to her waist, the unhappy woman did not hear, did not move, standing rigid, fixed to the spot with such force that no power on earth could have uprooted her. All three were blonde, with skin of milk-like freshness, the mother looking as delicate and innocent as the children. And in the stupor of this death of their happiness, in this sudden destruction of the joy which was meant to last forever, they continued their great cry, the scream that seemed to carry all the fearsome sufferings of humankind. Then Madame Caroline fell down on her knees. She was sobbing and stammering.
Oh, madame, you're tearing at my heart. Please, madame, drag yourself away from this sight. Come with me to the next room. Let me try to spare you just a little of this pain.
And still they stood there, a wild and pitiful group, the mother with the two little ones seeming almost a part of her, all three quite motionless, with their long pale hair hanging loose. And still there came that frightful screaming, like the wailing his kin make in the forest when hunters kill the parent stag. Madame Caroline was now standing, her head whirling. There were footsteps, then voices. No doubt a doctor arriving to certify the death. And she could stay no longer. She fled, pursued by the awful, endless lament that even out on the street, with the cabs rumbling by, she still seemed to be hearing. The sky was growing pale. It was cold, and she walked slowly, fearing her strange, disturbed appearance might lead to her being regarded as dangerous and arrested. Everything surged back into her mind. The whole story of the monstrous collapse of 200 million francs that had piled up so many ruins and crushed so many victims. What mysterious power, after so rapidly building that tower of gold, had simply destroyed it in this way? The same hands that had constructed it seemed to have been seized by madness and striven desperately to leave not a stone of it standing. Everywhere, cries of pain could be heard. Fortunes were crumbling with a noise like demolition carts being emptied into the public dump. It was the last remnants of the Beauvilliers estate. De Joie's savings, scraped together sou by sou. The profits, made by Cedille's great industry. The pensions the Maugendres had gained in their trade, all together pell-mell hurled with a crash into the depths of a cesspit that nothing seemed to fill. And then, there was Jean Trou drowning in alcohol. Sandorf drowning in filth. Massius, fallen back to his miserable life as an orders tout, chained to the bourse for life by his debts. And Fleury, now imprisoned as a thief, expiating the weaknesses of his tender heart. Sabatani and Fayot, fugitives galloping away in fear of the police. And even more distressing and pitiful were the unknown victims, the great anonymous flock of all those the crash had impoverished, leaving them shivering and lost, crying with hunger. Then there was death. Pistol shots ringing out from the four corners of Paris, Mazaud's shattered head, and Mazaud's blood which, drop by drop, amid luxury and the scent of roses, bespattered his wife and his little ones, howling with grief. And now, everything she had seen and heard over the last few weeks poured forth from Madame Caroline's bruised heart in a cry of execration for Saccard. She could no longer keep silent, no longer push him aside as if he didn't exist, to avoid having to judge and condemn him. He alone was guilty. This was clear in every one of the accumulated disasters, in their fearful and terrifying quantity. She cursed him, as her anger and indignation, held in for so long, now broke out in vengeful hatred, hatred of evil itself. Did she no longer love her brother then, that she had waited so long to hate the terrible man who was sole cause of their misfortunes? Her brother, that great innocent, that great worker so just and upright, soiled now by the indelible stain of prison. The victim she had been forgetting, the dear victim, even more painful than all the rest.
Ah, might Saccard never find forgiveness, nor anyone ever dare to plead his cause. Not even those who continue to believe in him, those who had known only his kindness. And might he die one day, alone and despised.
Madame Caroline looked up. She had reached the square and saw before her the Bourse. Twilight was falling, and the winter sky, laden with mist, had created behind the monument a cloud of dark and reddish smoke, as if from a fire, as if made from the flames and dust of a city stormed. And the Bourse stood out, grey and bleak in the gloom of the crash, which for the last month had left it deserted, open to the four winds, like a marketplace cleared by famine. It was the fatal periodic epidemic that ravages the markets, sweeping through every 10 to 15 years, the Black Fridays, as they are called, that strew the ground with wreckage. It takes years for confidence to be restored, and for the great banking houses to be rebuilt. Rebuilt until the day when the great passion for gambling gradually reawakens, blazes up, and sets the whole process in motion again, bringing a new crisis and sending everything crashing into a new disaster. But this time, behind that reddish smoke on the horizon, in the blurred and far-off parts of the city, could be heard a sort of muffled creaking, as of the imminent end of a world.